STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reasons, the show. Thank you so much for being a part of my afternoon and early evening here in Southern California. It's good to have you on board. Hey, 1,053 registrations. That's the final count when the dust settles for last weekend at Rethink. I mean, that's unbelievable. The first Rethink, 300 people. The second one last year, 600. Now we almost doubled that to nearly 1,200, 1,053. What a fabulous thing. I'm so excited about it. I got a lot to tell you about how the weekend went, which is fabulous. But I want to wait off on that for just a moment, because every once in a while, a friend of Stand to Reason drops by. That means somebody we've connected with and built a relationship with over the years. They stop by and they say hi to the staff, maybe sit in on a show and see how, you know, get underwhelmed. I think it sounds more dramatic when you're out there listening, and then when you come here, it's just a couple of people pushing buttons and talking together, you know. But in this case, that friend also works now with Ratio Christi, and we'll talk a little bit about what that organization is. Julie Lowe's, good to have you on board, Julie.
Hi, Greg. It's great to be here.
We have a little bit of a long-standing relationship. I don't want to say on and off, because it's not on and off, but it's just now and again we bump into each other. Mm-hmm. Tell our audience, the very first time that we met, I think, was when I was speaking in Missouri at the university there. What was that all
Correct.
About?
Tell me. Yeah. A campus organization brought you to the University of Missouri to give a talk on apologetics.
Uh-huh.
And our Sunday school class had been doing your material.
Uh-huh.
And we wanted to go see you live and in person and not just hear you on a podcast or a DVD.
So we
connected with you,
uh-huh,
and got to spend some time talking, mm-hmm, apologetics questions, and really appreciated
And
the
then
time
next
to do
time
that.
I was in town, we got together with some of your friends.
Right.
And we had a meal and we enjoyed company. And then
right,
every few years, it seems like we bump into each,
mm-hmm,
other somewhere. Last time was CIA about
right,
2 years ago.
2 years ago, I got to go to the Cross-Examine Instructors Academy. That
right,
had been a dream of mine.
Yeah.
I had been fearful to do it and finally got up the courage. And you were there, and Brett Kunkel, and of course, Frank Turek. And I had the pleasure of presenting before Brett and Frank as two of my,
uh-huh,
presenters. So that was nerve-wracking.
Yeah, well, look at it. You know, when you say you had to build up the nerve, you just seem so relaxed talking with people and so natural. Even here we are, you know, talking on the air, and you're yourself, you know, which is great. And now you have, after the time of connecting with Stand to Reason, benefiting from the kinds of things that we offer at a distance, as it were, a distance mentoring of sorts,
right,
and then learning from Frank and the rest at CIA, and now you're involved with Ratio Christi, which,
mm-hmm,
absolutely thrills me, because it is one of the most exciting things that I have seen happen in the last, say, 15 or 20 years. I mean, it hasn't really been around in the robust fashion that long, but I'm thinking about the last 15 or 20 years that I have seen this renaissance, mm-hmm, in Christian apologetics, Christian thought, the
right,
interest in the whole area of being thoughtful in Christianity. And then kind of midway there in the last 10 years, Ratio Christi has really, really jumped into full view. Tell us a little bit about what Ratio Christi is.
It's an apologetics club on university campuses.
Mm-hmm.
We exist to defend truth and reason,
mm-hmm,
and bring back sort of the renaissance of Christian thinking to, mm-hmm, the university campus. We have chapters that meet right now, and with last count I heard, about 150 chapters.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, that can be anywhere from expressed interest,
mm-hmm,
to fully functioning,
yeah,
but the growth has been astronomical.
Yeah.
We are meeting a need, and the culture demands it,
right,
you know, in this time for our Christian youth to be able to defend their reasons,
yeah,
for their faith.
Yeah, ergo Ratio Christi.
Right.
I think the last time that I got a number, I don't know if it was from Rick Schenker, who, mm-hmm, is he's not actually the founder, but he's the guy that's
right,
been in the driver's seat the last 10 years that really...
Actually, we will be 4 years old officially since Rick took it over.
You're kidding me.
Right. It started as a club on a campus at Appalachian State University. University. Uh-huh. One of the students graduated and went to seminary at SES. They expanded it.
Southern Evangelical Seminary,
right
where
but
we hold CIA
exactly.
in August.
But it was getting bigger than they could run. And at the same time, Rick was looking for a way to be involved in evangelism. That mm-hmm. is his heart. As he researched it and found this, he said, this is a movement getting ready to happen,
yeah.
and I want to help run it.
Yeah.
And one thing led to another, and I believe it'll be 4 years in February since he took it over.
Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. it's amazing in 4 years to have some kind of representation on 100
right.
and 50 campuses mm-hmm. in the country. It's just amazing what God is doing. And he's a hard worker. You know, it seems like every time I turn around while I'm traveling, I'm running
yeah.
into him or somebody from Ratio Christi. So I know that you guys are laying it down and, you know, doing the you're up early and to bed late, and you guys are all doing a good job. But at the same time, in 4 years, to see this expansion, it is just another evidence of God at work.
Amen.
Yeah, building the body of Christ, especially in this area. And I it's not a moment too soon. I mean, I'm thinking, I have news stories right here on my desk that maybe we'll get to in a while or not. But they just seem to, every time I turn around, there's something new happening where the culture is putting the crunch on a free expression of the gospel. And I mean here in the broadest sense, not just Christianity proper, classical Christianity, but the moral issues that flow naturally from Christianity. And for us to be able to make our case in the public square mm-hmm. here in the land of the free, it's getting more and more difficult, which, you know, we've watched this happen, and we shouldn't be surprised. Jesus warned us
right.
that this was going to be the case for every Christian. But to see it happening here is a little unsettling. But we're stepping up, and then to see God then respond with organizations like Ratio mm-hmm. Christi and the work that you're doing, Julie, to help them out, that's really, it's just fabulous. I'm kind of sitting back and watching all this happen.
This, we like, are too.
There you go.
yeah.
Like for 21 years now with Stand to Reason, I felt like we've had a tiger by the tail in the sense that we've been along for the ride.
Mm-hmm.
with what God's doing through our organization and now others and certainly Ratio Christi. So tell us your role. This must
My
be
role?
Kind of a little bit of a dream
it
come
is.
True for you.
It is.
Go ahead.
All right. Well, I need to thank Stand to Reason for helping me get to this point, because through learning about apologetics, it fueled a passion in me for this.
Mm-hmm.
I started studying on my own. I don't have a master's degree or anything. Mm-hmm. I am slowly but surely pursuing a certificate mm-hmm. from Biola.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew when I heard about apologetics, it was something that I needed to do as a Christian, and mm-hmm. especially for my boys.
Mm-hmm.
I have a son who's a sophomore in college, one who's a senior in high school, and my love for apologetics started about the time they were entering middle school
uh-huh.
when I knew they would really be coming up against different worldviews.
Sure.
One thing led to another, and I heard about Ratio Christi. I think I may have even heard of it
mm-hmm.
on your show.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew it was something that I could see myself being involved with, but I didn't see myself as a chapter director. I saw myself hopefully helping with the vision and mission mm-hmm. of the ministry. And just through connecting with the leadership, with Rick Schenker, with Blake Anderson, our COO,
right. mm-hmm.
we stayed in touch, going to CIA, mm-hmm. you know, helped.
I just saw Blake in August
right?
at CIA, right.
And one thing led to another, and I shared with them my passion and my desire to actually introduce more women,
mm-hmm.
especially moms, mm-hmm. to the need for apologetics and training our kids
mm-hmm.
in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a match. And
yeah.
I've been working for them for about a year now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm officially in charge of Ratio Christi Boosters, if you want to think of it like a booster club
mm-hmm.
for our ministry. It's just to people that love our mission and vision, want to be involved, much like me,
mm-hmm.
not as a chapter director or a student member,
mm-hmm.
but they want to support what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
They could pray for us. They could promote it to their churches, their college ministries, their youth ministries. They can certainly help provide for us. You know how that goes,
mm-hmm.
needing
sure,
funding
absolutely.
For your ministry.
Right.
And then also use the resources that we have, free resources on our website, to start training and teaching themselves and passing it on to their kids. Mm-hmm. And we think by doing that, we can help transform the world. Mm-hmm. And another way that we are hoping to help prepare, especially even at a younger level, because we know it's not just at the university now.
Right,
our kids need it even younger.
Absolutely.
We are rolling out Ratio Christi College Prep. And that's hopefully coming in early 2015.
Wow.
It is a way for adults to be to learn how to mentor youth in apologetics.
Hmm.
And then they could start a Ratio Christi College Prep Club at their church or school. And that will help the kids when they hit that college campus and are confronted by all those worldviews coming out at them. They won't be playing catch-up in learning how to defend their faith. They'll already have a basis.
This is so fantastic. Just even the last year at Stand to Reason, we've been talking more and more about the next generation and what we can do for those who are going to train the next generation. That's not going to be us. It's going to be parents and the youth leaders and local church people, boots on the ground types. And, you told me, as we were talking before the show, you told me a little bit about the story about how Rick spoke at a classical school and let's revisit that because it just shows the strategic importance of organizations like Ratio Christi and Stand to Reason and all the rest that are in play. And who knows what organizations or enterprises in the next 5 years God is going to move someone to develop. So tell us that story.
Yes. My sister actually works for a classical Christian school, and Tom Gilson, our national field director, wrote an article.
We've had Tom on the we talked about
True Reason, his book.
True Reason, his book, and also he talked about the atheist, I can't say Fabosian or whatever his
Peter Boghossian.
There you go. So we've had Tom on a couple of times, and we just love Tom's insight.
Well, he wrote an article about how he thought future leaders, the way to kind of save America, would come from students who have been trained in classical Christian education, who can think critically, think clearly, logically, and things like that. I passed the article on to my sister, and Rick ended up coming and speaking at an event that their church did to lay out what we see happening on the college campus. You know, we hear back from our chapter directors, Christian kids who come in beleaguered, you know, doubting their faith, not knowing how to stand up to things, and showing that teaching in critical thinking, logic, rhetoric, apologetics, theology, all of
it's
those
all
things,
in.
It's all tied in, and it really is a way to help further the cause of Christ and affect culture.
So I was talking with my daughter, who's nine, the other day, and she's just entering in classical terms, it's called the logic stage. It's where you can start putting the things together, the particulars kind of together in a coherent way. And so in the version of classical education that my daughters are involved in, which is called the trivium approach, and many of our listeners know about this, and you're familiar with it, of course, but in the logic stage, they are working more intentionally to help them put the particulars together. And this entails not just logic proper, but also what is the logic of the larger systems they're dealing with. In any event, she's been studying informal fallacies, and it has really been thrilling for me because we're driving along, listening to some things on the radio, and my daughter says, "That's an ad hominem." And, I mean, it warmed the cockles of my heart, you know. An ad hominem is an informal fallacy, popularly called name-calling, where you substitute derision for something substantive. And she not only knows what it is, and by the way, this is no credit to my daughter, because the concept's not hard to learn. It is a credit to her school that is willing to teach this to her, and so anybody's 9 year old can figure out name calling isn't an appropriate way to win an argument, but that she's now alerted to it, she sees it coming, and she can label it as such, and then she understands that does not address the issue.
Right,
it addresses something else. So when Rick then is telling the school this is the future for us, is our kids that are able to do this, not just those trained in classical education per se, but those discipled by their parents to be able to see foolishness when it rears its ugly head, those are the kids that are going to make the biggest difference.
Right.
And we get a chance to participate in that. Julie, one thing that I liked about Ratio Christi, when I first really got the big picture, and this was at an SES conference about 4 years ago, and Rick was there, and Tom Gilson was there, and in fact, I think Tom was doing the introduction about where do we go from here as a community, and that's when they said, here's what we're launching. It was great. One of the things that appealed to me about it, maybe you can speak to this a little bit for our listeners, is the idea that that new opportunities were being created by this organization for people who are getting training but are not sure what they can do with it, in a sense, professionally or in more ongoing active ministry, as opposed to just their daily life and their own encouragement and their own ability to engage others thoughtfully. And that itself would be end enough. But there are a lot of people who want to do more.
Right.
And I saw, hey, Ratio Christi is making, in a certain sense, job opportunities
here.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
The main job opportunity that there would be there for somebody who truly is pursuing, say, a master's in theology or apologetics for further study in that would be to come on and be one of our chapter directors, because we want trained apologists who are interacting with the students weekly on campus at their chapter meetings and training them in apologetics. Mm-hmm. So one could easily go on our website, ratiochristi.org, and there's a whole section there on how to become a chapter director, what it takes to be one. Right.
And they wouldn't have to move. Mm-hmm. They could just start a chapter where they're at.
Exactly.
And
bloom where you're planted, which you taught me.
Yeah, well, I've heard that before. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so they can, in a certain sense, create a job for themselves. I know, for example, at Pepperdine University, one of the John Noyes from my church, who's now a staff person on our church, but he wasn't before. He's in the legal profession, and he helped start that chapter at Pepperdine, and he still serves that chapter, even though he's so. This is the same kind of thing,
And the other thing too is we are even seeing people who want to start chapters at community colleges. That's fine. Universities, it can be Christian colleges as well as secular. So there's many different venues for that to play out at.
And if somebody wanted to, had a vision for doing this full time, this is a matter of there are other hoops to jump through and raising support and all those other things, but the potential is there if the need is there, you know, and the opportunity. So what a great thing. One last thing here. You mentioned you're a Stand to Reason person and your bracelet. Your bracelet. What a magnet. Tell us about the bracelet. I just was really touched by this. So you can try to describe this is a silver bracelet.
Right. Well, I have to give a shout out to my Sunday school teacher, Michael Cruz, who introduced me to Stand to Reason. Mm-hmm. And I've been following you guys for about 6 or 8 years now. And you talk about the ambassador model of knowledge, wisdom, and character.
Right.
That's really stuck with me. So I decided to put together a bracelet that's my ambassador bracelet. Mm-hmm. And on it, I have charms. There is a Bible charm that represents knowledge, because that's where my knowledge should come from.
I don't know if you could say Bible and charm in the same
sentence.
But all right, we know what you're talking about. Okay.
Then I have an owl to represent wisdom. That's the best I could do on that.
That's great.
And then for character, I have a pearl, because a pearl develops over time, and so does your character.
Oh.
Sometimes it takes a little irritation to develop that character. And there's also a little flower on here, which is to represent, hopefully, that as an ambassador, I will leave the fragrance of Christ wherever I go.
That is magnificent. Yeah. What a great application. Oh. When we're done here, I want you to go in and see Amy and have her take a photo of that, and she can post it tomorrow when she does her blog about the show. But what a treat to talk with you.
Thank you.
All the best to you, Julie.
Thank you. And
continue.
Can I get in one other plug?
Yeah, sure.
We do have our symposium coming up. Ratio Christi Symposium is October 11th and 12th, right outside of Charlotte in Fort Mill, South Carolina.
Okay.
anyone interested in learning more about apologetics in general or about Ratio Christi is welcome to come. Just go on our website and sign up. And we have a special retreat this year for students. Mm-hmm. It can be anywhere from a junior and senior in high school mm-hmm. on up to college kids. Uh-huh.
RatioChristi.org.
Okay. And Josh McDowell.
RatioChristi. Did I get it right?
You got it.
Just the way it sounds.
Right. And Josh McDowell and David Limbaugh will be our keynote speakers at our dinner on Saturday evening.
Oh,
so
man.
That'll be a fabulous evening.
Those are two heavyweights.
Yeah.
Oh, super,
we
super.
Feel
David
very
Limbaugh
honored.
Would be Rush Limbaugh's brother.
Yep.
You know, I hate to do the name association, but he's pretty well known all by himself.
And he just came out with a brand new book, too. I think it's Jesus on Trial, I believe.
You know, I haven't seen the book, but mm-hmm. I know that he just had an interview with Dennis Prager,
right?
I think. And I just heard about that secondhand. I'd like to listen to it myself when I get around to that, catching up on the Dennis's shows. But anyway, what a treat to have you on board, Julie, and
appreciate
all the best
the time.
To you and all your work with Ratio Christi.
Thank you. We appreciate you guys.
Oh, that's great. Great talking to you. All right, let's take a break, and we'll come back with more here on Stand to Reason. Don't go away.
You can find STR on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians. Want to know what is going on with STR? Speaking events, new podcasts, resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find all of our social media connections at str.org.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to idonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit idonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
Wow, great talking to Julie. You never know. You make friends, right? You meet them at places, and they go to your Facebook. They friend you. They leave remarks. They do things. You connect with them again, and, you know, relationships are built. I have a lot of friends. I'm just thinking of now. I've got a lot of friends that I know just through radio or through, you know, this kind of thing. People that connected with the show and show up at an event and you know, it's great, and it's great to be an encouragement and then to see how they are blooming where they're planted, just like Julie Lowe's is doing and so many others. This reminds me, and I want to just toss this. I was in Atlanta last week, and I met some old friends, which was great. Somebody I hadn't seen in about 25 years, and walking with the Lord and serving the Lord. But it's just great to connect with people that, in this case, I knew him but hadn't seen him for so long. Now he's living in Atlanta, and God is working through him and things that he's doing there, and he brought me up to date, Brad. And really, maybe it's even 30 years since I've seen him. He's in a discipleship group that I'd led way back when. We did carpentry work together, you know. I mean, and then kind of right out of the past, here is this mature Christian man, married. He actually had a baby at 27, his first baby. I'm sorry, at 57. My first was 54, and I thought I was stretching it. My second was 57. He had his first at 57, but he is up for it, and he's really thrilled. And so good for that. I'm going to tell you about somebody else I met, and I'm a little nervous about mentioning this, but I'm just going to take a chance because my heart was so touched by a young man who came up to me to express to me how much Stand to Reason had meant to him. And I was encouraged by him, and maybe what I tell you about that incident will be an encouragement to you. The young man came up with a friend, and he began to talk and say thank you, essentially, but he had a bad stutter, and it was difficult for him to get started. His friend helped him out a little bit, and I just waited him out. It was fine, and then he relaxed a little bit. Then we had a conversation, and he went on to express to me how much he appreciated Stand to Reason and how STR, and particularly tactics, had helped him be more effective in communicating his convictions to other people about Christ. But I want to tell you what he did for me, not what I did for him or Stand to Reason did for him. Because what he did for me and what I hope he'll do for you is really significant. He came up and expressed to me the benefit that we had offered him. And the only way he could express it is in terms of or in spite of or along with his disability, however you want to talk about it. He was willing to put himself out to say thank you, though he was having a hard time communicating. And I realized this is a person who is a committed ambassador for Christ, who is talking not just with me in this way, but every single person that he talks with about Christ is a person that he talks with having to overcome his own self-consciousness and his own concerns about the way he communicates. But he's still willing to do it. You think you have a difficult time talking about your convictions? How about a person that has a hard time speaking at all? Yet he is willing to step out to be an ambassador for Christ with whatever difficulties he has at the moment. In spite of those, regardless of those, he's still willing to take a chance because what he has to communicate is so important. I'm sorry, but I don't remember his first name. I just want to say that my hat is off to him as a brother in Christ because of the confidence and courage that he expressed. I should say the courage that he expressed, and I guess he'd have to have confidence in the message, certainly to be willing to step out under those circumstances. All of the above is magnificent. I mean, I was almost touched to tears. So thank you so much, young man, for saying hi to me and for being so brave and courageous and such an example to the rest of us. And for the rest of us, I'm telling you, you have no excuses, right? None. That was great. Now, I had mentioned a little while ago about our conference this last weekend, Rethink Apologetics, and how we blew out all the stops with 1053, the final number of those who signed up. My daughter and I arrived Friday afternoon. We drove up. I picked up Annabeth at, she's my 9-year-old, at noonish or 12:30, and then we drove up the coast. We had to stop at Stand to Reason. We made a couple of stops here there, but got in about 5:15, time for the dinner at 5:30 for the faculty and staff, and then people started drifting in very soon. By 6 o'clock, people were coming in for the 7 o'clock event. I had learned that morning more than 1,000 had signed up already in advance, and I was wondering, man, how are they going to process all these people? At 7 o'clock, that auditorium that held about 1,200 people was filled to the gills, which includes the balcony. Front to back, fore to aft, right to left, everything, stage right, stage left, top to bottom, filled with excited young people. And there was a Twitter feed that somebody had actually just put up on the screen. So as people are coming and arriving and expressing themselves on Twitter, these lines are just popping up and the whole thing's scrolling as more people are weighing in, not even knowing that their tweet has just been made public to everyone. And you could just feel the electricity and the intensity and the excitement. It was just magnificent. And I'm sitting in the front row with Annabeth, and the worship team is getting ready to go. At 7 o'clock, they kick it off, and I thought the worship team was fabulous. I don't know who the team were. What I liked is that they had good energy. They were not overly loud for my tastes. The one friend of mine said, "Cokel, if it's too loud, you're too old." In any event, it was there. Everybody was singing along. The whole audience was worshiping along. Every once in a while, they'd drop to a cappella. They'd stop the instruments, let the audience just sing. It was a great launch there in worship. And it turns out the majority of kids in the audience were not college kids, but high school kids, and some even younger. And they were there with their parents. They were there with their youth group leader. One group of 25 students came from Phoenix. Actually, there are two groups from Phoenix, one of 15 and the other 25. Brett Kunkel led off with a great opening talk about the nature of truth. Powerful, accessible, funny. Then is it Tim Barnett, right? Is he the... Brooke is Tim Barnett. He was number two guy in line from Canada. He's a physics teacher in high school in Canada. Did a knockdown, wonderful presentation with PowerPoint and everything about the fine-tuned constants of physics and the solar system. I mean, he just brought my daughter saying, "Hey, we're studying astronomy now. I like that one the best. Look at that. There it is." And funny and accessible, and I think we went to 10:30, and nobody was tired. Everybody's roaring to go. But we had to call it a night, got up the next morning, kicked off with, I think, Sean McDowell was next, and did the authority of the Bible and the reliability of the New Testament, and he was just great, and Alan Schliemann, and we had breakout sessions. I did a session on the issue of hell. And had a good turnout in my session. There were three going at the same time. Great responsiveness. Just speaking in a straightforward, clear, no holds barred fashion about the reality of hell. No excuses, no apologies. Jesus believed it. That means if you're a Christian, you ought to believe it. And if you're not a Christian, you at least ought to think about it, because Jesus was no slouch, was he? Now, Alan Schliemann, that I mentioned, he did "Why I'm Not an Evolutionist" at right after the lunch session. All of the adults got together, the pastors and the parents. They were invited to a special luncheon and filled the gallery for that in one of the side rooms, maybe 100 people. Special luncheon that we catered just for them. And then Brett, while they're eating, Brett got to talk to them about the future, the importance of discipling the young people so that they can carry the torch after we've hung up our cleats, right? And that's what we have to do. We got to get it ourselves, and we got to pass it on. And that was great. Listen, by mid-afternoon, my daughter was wilting a little bit. What an intense time we'd had. So we began our long trek back, 3 hours plus traffic, you know, to get back home, which we did. But I tip my hat to everybody working on the team, the church Crossline, who sponsored it, and their all their efforts and all the speakers and all the students, 1,000 plus. My prayer for this weekend was that the young people, even or adults that attended this conference, would be able to leave the conference and changed people, that years from now they would look back on what took place this last weekend and they would say, that was the place where everything changed for me. That was the place where there was a turnaround. That was the place where I got it. That's the place where God got me, and I surrendered. That was the place where I got the big picture, and I decided to follow and to be fruitful. That's the place where I decided to bloom where I was planted and to never look back, put my hand to the plow and move forward. That was the place. And who knows, maybe some of you listening years from now will be able to tell me whether in your case that prayer was answered at that conference. I know that's going to be the case for some people because I know how God works in things like that. That when people step forward like our team, faithfully giving what they have, that God steps forward in the lives of other people and makes changes that go on forever. And that's what we're after. So it'll be interesting to see. Now, we're still shooting for next year. We're going to do the same thing in Southern California. And we are looking to take this enterprise on the road, rethink Student Apologetics Conference. We already have a very live option. We're talking seriously about Dallas, Texas. Can't give you the details right now, not until it's inked. But doing one in Dallas, I don't know if it'll be 2015 or not. We are going to reprise this rethink in 2015 here in Southern California. But we also are having conversations with people in like five other big cities. And we're looking at like Charlotte and Atlanta and Tulsa, Oklahoma, and San Francisco Bay Area. And there may be more. Again, talk is talk. Once we get commitments from local churches that can that believe in what we're doing here, then we'll make this more public. But you can be praying about that. And we just want to keep, as part of our strategy for the next 10 years, having an impact on the next generation, this is a major part of that strategy, and we want to keep pursuing that. So, again, we are so thankful for what God did this last weekend through Ratio Christi. And look forward to see the impact of that as it reverberates down the line. Let's take a quick break and come back to your calls. The number here is 855-243-9975. You can call that when the show is live, and that would be Tuesday afternoons from 4 until 7 p.m. Los Angeles time. Once again, 855-243-9975. And if you're outside of the U.S., you can still call us. You just got to do the math with the time zones and dial direct at 562-424-8229. Back with more in just a moment. You're listening to Stand to Reason.
The Apostle Paul knew well the effect on those who engaged in empty chatter as they spread the virus of false knowledge. They went astray. So while entrusting the treasure of truth to Timothy, his disciple, and encouraging Timothy to entrust it to other faithful men, Paul also exhorted him to guard the treasure in 2 Timothy 1:14. Paul's word guard comes from the activity or office of a watchman who has the job of protecting those who are asleep from harm. It implies a deliberate, conscious act and demands discernment in knowing what it is that's been placed under our care. Guard the treasure was Paul's final message to Timothy before Paul's death. It reflected the heartbeat of his ministry. It reflects the heartbeat of Stand to Reason, too. Guard the treasure which has been entrusted to you. To learn more about Stand to Reason and how we're training Christian ambassadors to guard the treasure, visit us at str.org. Our website is full of unique and useful resources to train you to be an effective ambassador for Christ. That's str.org.
Would you like brief, easily digestible answers to some of the challenges you face as a Christian ambassador? Well, that's why we created our Ambassador's Guide series of booklets. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. With these booklets, you'll receive concise and approachable guides to various philosophies like pluralism and postmodernism, world religions such as Islam and Mormonism, even strategies on how to answer the challenges of the new atheists. To order a booklet from the Ambassador's Guide series, visit our online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON.
Greg Kokel, one of the good guys here. doing my best to equip you to think every week, 3 hours a week. That's what we give you. As I say frequently to audiences, it's just one L.A. commute. So, you know, it's not burdensome. Part of your diet on a regular basis for Clear Thinking Christianity. Oh, which, by the way, I mentioned Tim Barnett, who had spoken for us this last weekend. He's from Toronto. And his organization, his enterprise is actually called Clear Thinking Christianity. And I think that's in part because of the influence Stand to Reason has had on him. So we're really glad to hear that. But he's knocking it out there in Toronto. Apparently doing a lot of events up in that neck of the woods. So just want you to be aware of him and check out his website, which I think is clearthinkingchristianity.org, or Tim Barnett. Okay, let's go to our callers here. And I got Scott on in Warren, PA, which would probably be Pennsylvania.
Yeah, right? It is. Hi, Greg.
Hey, Warren. I mean, Scott. Sorry. Scott and Warren.
That's right.
All right. What's up?
Well, I was wondering, I've got some friends who talk a bunch about N.T. Wright and his new perspectives on Paul, and I was wondering if you could shed any light on his teachings and maybe what the controversy is, so I can kind of wrap my head around it a little.
Yeah, well, you know what, I'm unfortunately not going to be able to help you too much. Let me say a little bit about it, but this is one of those controversies that it's got people stirred up, and some people think he means one thing, and other people think he means another thing, and so it's hard to weigh in a sense, accurately and precisely when there's that much confusion. So let me just lay a little foundation. N.T. Wright is a New Testament professor or specialist, bishop actually, of Durham. Durham is a city in central England, actually a little bitty burg sitting on a hill with a huge cathedral on the top of it, and there's a college or university associated with it, and that's Durham, and that's where N.T. Wright was bishop for a long time. He's no longer there. I think he's up in Scotland somewhere. That's where he's hanging his hat now. But he's most well known for a seminal work that he did, his magnum opus on the resurrection of Jesus. And I think that's the title of it, Resurrection of Jesus, or Resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth, or Resurrection of Jesus the Christ, something like that. But N.T. Wright, Thomas N.T. Wright is his name, and or Tom Wright, as his friends call him. We're not friends, but some people refer to him in that way. So his work on the resurrection is magnificent. And making the case, especially that New Testament, the New Testament, what's the word I'm looking for? Mentality, the thinking of the time. No one was expecting the Messiah to die. It was the last thing from anybody's mind, and so you cannot account for the testimony of the resurrection as something that was invented by the disciples, because a dying and rising Messiah was the farthest thing from anybody's mind in that Second Temple period, okay? And so therefore he reasons that the best explanation for the birth of the church and the accounts of the resurrection, which was central to the birth of the church, is that a resurrection actually took place. So his book on this is really, 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 really good. Okay. Now he's done other work, and he's done work on what exactly was Paul all about in his doctrine, and this touches on the doctrine of salvation and the nature of the reconciliation of the Jews with the Gentiles. And this is where I've read some things on it, and it strikes me, or has struck me as not utterly esoteric, but I was just thinking, this isn't my area. I'm not that interested in this controversy, so I didn't get into it that much, you know. Now, I was just asking some people on the staff, and they said, well, you know, it to some degree, there's some discussion, and this is, so I'm just getting feedback from some of our staffers who've gone into it a little deeper about what was the nature of the significance of the combining the Jews and the Gentiles into one new man. Was it just to create peace to reconcile the Jews with the Gentiles? And I think that, from what I understand, N.T. Wright is leaning a little bit in that direction. Or was it about reconciling Jews and Gentiles in one new man to God? What was the main thrust? Now, my take in the New Testament is that it was to reconcile the Jews and the Gentiles together in one new man to God. Or actually, okay, in the reconciliation to God, they became one new man in the church, where there's neither Jew nor Gentile, slave nor free, male or female, etc., but all are one in Christ. And so what God intended to do was to create a bride for his son in which there are both Jew and Gentiles and members from every nation, having used the nation of Israel as the central piece in his rescue plan to bring a reconciliation between the world and himself. And that ultimately was through the new covenant and the person of Jesus who died in our place. But I guess there is some question, and this is where you can't quote me because I'm not for sure, but there's some question, at least in some people's minds, as to whether N.T. Wright, in his new perspective on Paul, holds to the substitutionary atonement view, the fact that Jesus died in our place. So that's why there's so much controversy, because the question is this New Testament scholar who's done so much for the cause of Christianity in his book on the resurrection now undermining the central tenets of Christianity in his new perspective on Paul? That's the nature of the controversy. But again, I'm not dialing it down because I can't speak accurately about the details.
Right.
And
I know there had been I know people like John Piper had written some, I don't want to call it refutations, but
response
to it. And from what I gather, I wasn't able to read the entire article because it was on Christianity Today, and I was online, and you can only read a piece of it. There was something about it that Piper thought was damaging to the way that we understand justification.
Yeah.
Over the last 1,500 years.
Uh-huh.
And so, and I've listened to hours and hours of podcasts with N.T. Wright speaking, and I don't know if I just don't connect with him or something, but I can almost never give a short synopsis of what he just said after I've just listened to him for an hour and a half.
I don't know that yep. I've ever seen him speak. I've been at events where he was present. I don't know that I ever saw him. Sometimes you have people who make a tremendous contribution in the writing, and they just don't deliver in person with the same power. It's just a different gift. Some people are really good in person but can't deliver so much in writing. Other people can do both. So
yeah, I think he just talks over my head more than anything. I think he's a brilliant communicator, probably. At least he sounds smart because he's British.
That makes him sound better. But I just want you to think about what you said just a moment ago. He talks way over my head. I think that he's a brilliant communicator, probably. Well, if he was a brilliant communicator, there would be no probably about it, because he would have communicated effectively with you. He's a brilliant man, no probably about that. And he may be a brilliant communicator with a different level, in a different level of the academy. But if he's speaking to popular audiences, I've often said that the key characteristic of a good communicator is clarity. Because without clarity, then you're not communicating. And if you're not communicating, then you're not doing what you're intending to do, getting your ideas across effectively to other people. So some people speak to different levels. I know people have told me that they think William Lane Craig is fabulous, intelligent, but they can't follow everything. And with my background, I listen to him and I think he's as clear as a bell. But that's because I know some of the terms of art and I could traffic a little bit at that level. People who are not maybe have that a higher level academic background in philosophy need a translator, and this is what Stand to Reason tries to do. We try to translate take the ideas and then make them more accessible without losing their significance. And so we're speaking to a little different audience.
Yeah. Well, you do it well, and I could say the same, but I've listened to hundreds of hours of your podcast, and it's the reason why I've become a strategic partner, because you have helped me in a lot of ways to think clearly. So I very much appreciate that in my own life.
Well, I'm glad we can play that role in your life. So good to have you on board, and thanks for your financial help for Stand to Reason as well.
Yeah, thanks, Craig. Good to talk to you.
All right, Scott. Thank you. I appreciate the call. In Ohio, Jeffrey, you're on board. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Greg. It's a pleasure to talk with you. I've actually never called in before, but I'm a little bit nervous. So,
well, you're doing fine. You're doing fine so far, Jeff.
Okay, thanks.
Sure.
I had a question for you. I forget which episode it was or which week it was when you mentioned this, but I remember you said that you didn't get married until you were 48 years old.
That's right. I actually had my 48th birthday on my honeymoon.
Oh, nice. That'd be a good way to celebrate.
It was. Actually, to be honest, I was deathly sick on my 48th birthday, now that I recall. We went to, we were in like New Hampshire, and then we went across the border to Montreal, and we had a night out and dinner and everything, and I don't know what it was, but by the time I got back, I was really sick. So I recovered within 24 hours, but it was a memorable 48th birthday, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's awesome. So my question, I'm actually 27. I just turned 27 about a month ago.
A youngster.
Yeah. Well, relatively speaking, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to a seminary, and I'm one of the only single guys in my classes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to a seminary to eventually become a pastor.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been feeling kind of like insecure about the prospect of being a pastor as a single man, because I don't know if officiating weddings or really like doing pastoral counseling in the context of marriage counseling and those types of things, if that would be appropriate for me as a single guy. So I just wanted to hear your perspective on that, because I definitely feel called to ministry, and I actually have a full ride scholarship. So God's really opened up some great doors for that.
Super.
But I just want to make sure that I'm on track with, you know, more of the personal side of things, I guess.
Yes. I do not see why there would be any, in a sense, moral problem with you being a single person in ministry. I don't see that at all. And as to whether you'll be able to be a good pastor in all the different areas that a pastor is required to give counsel and be a shepherd, I don't see the limitation there at all. Well, when I say at all, I'm saying that I think in every single area you will have, in principle at least, something to offer. Now, is there an insight that one gains about marriage from being married? Yeah, I would say so. Is there an insight one gains about child rearing from having one's own children? The answer is absolutely. Does that mean that a person who is not married can't say anything substantive about the marriage relationship? No, it doesn't mean that. Does it mean that a person who has no children can't say anything substantive about raising children? No, it doesn't mean that either. And in fact, if your job is to communicate the truth of Scripture, I don't see why being married or having children is an elemental part of communicating the truth about family and children and marriage and the things that relate to those things that you find in Scripture. I don't see that at all. You can still communicate all of those things. I do think that you're going to have, if and when you get married and if and when you have children, there is an added dimension. I'd be foolish to say otherwise. But your question is about adequacy. And I think that you can be fully capable of fulfilling your responsibilities as a pastor, even though you yourself, and this has to do even with marital issues and child-rearing issues, even though you yourself, if you choose to remain single and therefore childless, you can still do that. I don't see any difficulty at all. And in fact, look at Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7, and I know you're familiar with this passage, because he talks about the question of being married or not being married, or maybe it's 1 Corinthians, yeah, it's 7. And what he says in this, this actually is the longest discussion in the Bible that I know of on the question of marriage, on the issue of marriage. The longest, because from chapter 7, verse 1, all the way to what? Pretty much the whole chapter. I got 40-some verses here. What? Yeah, 40 verses. The discussion is about about marriage, about its liabilities, about its benefits, about its moral obligations, about being single and its benefits and its liabilities and its moral obligations. So both are in view here. And one of the things that Paul says about being single is that if you are single, you have a huge advantage with regards to ministry. And in fact, I was just thinking about it when you said you're one of two people or something in your educational program that's single.
Yeah, there's a few like older couples, or not older couples, but there's a couple older students who have gotten divorces, but it seems like everybody is at a little bit of a later stage in life, so most of them are either married or have been married in the past.
Right, but I guess what the reason I bring it up is because you can just compare the burden for the person who is married and going through your educational program and the burden that you're experiencing going through that program. Your job is a lot easier. This is what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7. He said, look, you know, if you're not married, you can give yourself without distraction to the things of the Lord. And he calls it undistracted devotion to the Lord, he says. Now, some people who are single, and this was me, it was like undevoted distraction because, you know, I wanted to be married, and so I didn't have the gift of celibacy, and so I eventually got married. If being single was a liability to being a good minister, Paul would not be approving of singleness so heartily in this regard. It frees you up. So I would, you know, give what you're capable of giving. Be a faithful servant of the Lord, blooming where you're planted right now. And if you choose not to get married, and you can continue to minister. Will there be things that you won't be able to give? Somewhat, yes. Will there be things that you will be able to give that others who are married won't? Yes. See, each person has their own station and can provide something unique. So that's my recommendation to you, Scott. And you did a great job for your first time on the air. So thanks so much for the call. That's it for our first hour here at Stand to Reason. More coming up. Stay with us. I'm Greg Kokel. All right, back at you here. Stand the Reason, the show. Greg Kokel, the host. And let's see, you're up next. So let's go to Boston and Stephen. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Greg. How are you doing?
Doing okay, thanks. What's up?
Good, good. Actually, my wife and I are both big fans of the show, and we met you. I think you were up here right at 2 years ago. It was fall of 2012.
It was two years ago. I remember it well, and had a fabulous time in Boston. I got taken out of the town quite a bit too in the Italian district, and we ate like crazy when I was there. But I had a lot of fun with everybody that was hosting me, and also with the people I got a chance to serve.
Yeah, yeah. The gentleman, Adam, that I think was your main host, he and I are good friends and everything. And so,
give him my best.
Yeah. So let me give you a little context, and then I'm just going to make an observation and get your feedback on it here. I was talking with a friend of mine who was telling me that she does not believe that homosexuality is sinful.
Uh-huh.
And now she comes from a conservative evangelical background, but I guess over the course of time, she's heard arguments that, you know, the church was wrong on racism or science or all sorts of things. And generally, the church is good, but occasionally it needs some kind of correction from culture or academia or wherever.
Yeah, and that's the place to get it.
Exactly.
The culture is going to set the church straight, yeah.
Exactly, exactly. And so I think that she would probably say that that's where we are today with homosexuality. So the rub is, though, is that she would say that homosexuality is not sinful, yet I know from her background and conversations that we've had that she would still say that we are all sinners and need to repent of sin to be born again.
Uh-huh.
But as we're talking and I'm hearing and I'm thinking on this and asking her questions and things, it dawns on me, good luck finding a church that believes that. In our world, it seems that either you'll find a church that faithfully preaches the gospel and what it means for all sin, homosexuality included,
mm-hmm.
or you'll find something that affirms homosexuality and is soft on sin across the board.
Uh-huh.
And so, I mean, I don't know. It was just an observation that I had that just kind of was like a light bulb that went off. That if you in our world, in our culture, if you where we find ourselves today in 2014, if you concede homosexuality, you're implicitly conceding sin as a whole. And maybe some would call, you know, they'd probably call just most grotesque things like murder or genocide or rape or anything like that, but it just kind of dawned on me when she was saying that. I was like, good luck finding that.
Well, I think she's going to have a hard time finding a church that is genuinely substantive enough that it's going to give you a robust understanding of the gospel, but then accept her view on the issue of homosexuality. I think it's going to be... Now, there are going to be churches that may not mention homosexuality, but they will advance Christ, but they won't mention homosexuality. But if push came to shove and you asked them, the pastor, what's the deal? What does the Bible say on this? Then I think the pastor is going to acknowledge, well, the Bible does say that homosexuality is wrong or a sin, but I'm just not going to preach on it like maybe a bunch of other things that make people uncomfortable. There are going to be churches that I think are going to think homosexuality is just fine, but then there are other sins that are bad. You still need forgiveness for those. But I do think she's really limiting her options there. But I have a different question for her, though, Stephen, and that is, where is she? And I think she needs to be asked this. I'm interested to hear what she says is her answer. I think we know the answer a little bit, but I want to hear her say it. Where does she get her cues from as to what is right and what is wrong? Now, I think we both agree that she's being influenced by her culture. But, I mean, ultimately, would she say, look, we take a poll and the culture decides? I don't think she'd really say that. If she identifies herself as a Christian, though she has some differences, then the question is going to be, okay, well, where do you get your cues from? How do you know ultimately what's right and what is wrong?
Mm-hmm.
Well, God has to speak on these things, right? And so, the real question should be, if God says this is wrong, isn't that good enough for us, her and you and I, Christians, if God says it? Now, we may not understand some things, but if God says it clearly that it's wrong, would that be enough for her? Now, this thing that, well, we got racism wrong in the past. Well, wait a minute. The Bible doesn't teach racism is right.
Yeah.
You know, Jesus didn't say racism is right. So yeah. I don't know what. And just because somebody got something wrong in the past does not mean they're wrong in this issue now. It's irrelevant.
Yeah. The argument that I gave her on the issue of racism or slavery, or any, I think she points, you know, at churches in the South, you know, 200 years ago that tried to defend slavery and all sorts of things. Well, I countered her and I said, William Wilberforce fought tooth and nail against slavery for the whole of his adult life because of his Christianity.
That's right.
And because he saw the sin that it was.
Yep, that's
so,
right.
You know, I don't think you can pick and choose there.
Yeah, well, this is what she's doing. And so here's a question to put to her on that particular point. Churches in the South, you just ask her straight out, were they right or were they wrong? Were they right or were they wrong? Because right now we got Wilberforce on one side and churches in the South on the other. Okay, now who is biblically right? What is she going to say?
Hopefully Wilberforce.
Well, yeah, I don't know what else she could say. The churches in the South were wrong.
Yeah.
And Wilberforce is biblically right. Now, they're not wrong in the South because the culture now says they're wrong. They were wrong in the South then because the Bible says they're wrong. And maybe they misunderstood it. But if she isn't willing to say they misunderstood and got it wrong, then she's got to say the Bible teaches racism. And if the Bible teaches racism, then why should she believe anything in the Bible? You know, if they were wrong, it's only wrong because the Bible doesn't teach that. It teaches a different ethic. Wilberforce got it right. The churches in the South got it wrong. And so again, this is an attempt to get her to look at the Bible and not culture, even Christian culture. Okay. So the question now is, what does the Bible weigh in at all?
Yeah.
On this particular issue. And I don't get it how I guess I do a little bit. If people want to believe one thing because of cultural pressure or because of own experience or whatever, then they're going to find a way to rationalize and sanitize. And so I can understand how that works, but it gives me pause, though, when somebody says they're a Christian and they think homosexuality is fine. And Christians just say it isn't. They're wrong. I say, wait a minute. Christians didn't make this up. They got it from the Bible. How about Romans 1? I mean, and this is, there is no way to get around Romans 1, period. There's no way to do it. All the nonsense that people, all the dancing they do to get around it, it doesn't work because Paul's talking about plumbing there. He's talking about functions. The man abandoned the natural function of the woman. Men abandoned women. God made men and women to fit together. And man said, no, I'm not going to take what God has provided for me. I'm going to make my own provision. That's idolatry. That's the same as man does in all kinds of other things. So how do you get around that, you know, Christian friend? I don't know. So there's maybe something else is going on with her. If she continues to side this way with the culture on this particular point. The real question is, where is she getting her cues? Where is she getting her cues? How does she know what is right and what is wrong? You don't look at the church. You got to look at the Bible. And by the way, on this particular point, though many people say Jesus never said anything about homosexuality, this is actually technically true but substantively false. It's technically true in that we have no record of Jesus weighing in on homosexuality per se. Substantively, he did weigh in on something that addresses the broader issue. He says regarding divorce, from the beginning, it has been male and female, the two become one flesh. What God joins together, let no man tear asunder.
Yeah.
He tells the entire story there that deals with everything on our plate right now culturally that has to do with sex. Everything is right there in that statement. Jesus tells us how it's supposed to be. One man, one woman, joined together for life, and that's where sex takes place. crystal clear. So if she's got a beef, she doesn't have a beef with churches who were wrong about racism in the past, now they're wrong about homosexuality. She's got a beef with Jesus of Nazareth. And maybe somebody ought to point that out to her. I don't know.
Yeah.
I know you're doing it. You're doing your best to do it. I'm glad you're there for her. But there's some more thoughts on the issue.
Definitely. Well, thank you very much.
All righty.
All right. You have a good one.
Okay, Stephen, thanks for your call. Let's go to an early break, and then we'll come back with more callers on Stand to Reason.
You can find STR on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians. Want to know what is going on with STR? Speaking events, new podcasts, resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find all of our social media connections at str.org.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to idonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit idonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
All right. Okay. I think I got a bad connection, actually, in my headset right there, and I just fixed it, and that's why. Maybe if it sounded like I made some false starts there to you listening, it's because I couldn't hear myself. Okay. Bad wire right here. Got it. I was thinking during the break, though, just about, I'm just still a bit mystified about those who identify themselves as Christians and then kind of go along with the pop sexual ethic. That's been in place really since the 60s. You know, free love is what we called it back then. At least we called it love, free love. You know, now it's just hooking up, you know, and everything else that goes along with that. But it just amazes me that people have this sense that they can be Christians and kind of go along with that when the Bible is really clear about the impropriety. See, even I'm kind of euphemizing it. The sinfulness, the wickedness of using sex outside of what God intended, which is one man, one woman in marriage for life. And I know some people are thinking, gee, well, times have changed, and it's really hard to support this ethic. Are you kidding me? Times have changed? Nothing's changed. Do you think that the first century people were a bunch of Puritans? Come on. No way. It's always been hard for Christians to do what's right in the face of the culture, sometimes harder than others. But the first century wasn't any easier than it is now, especially since here in the West, nobody's shedding blood for their convictions. And that's what was going on for many of the Christians, to live the way they lived in faithfulness to Christ. And here we are, you know, dropping like flies for what? So because we don't want to be called a name. We don't want somebody to look at us oddly. That's all, that we're not made of any better stuff than that. Okay, just a heads up, coming November 1st, Solid Ground. It's called The Line in the Sand. So I'm going to be talking about the very thing. It's already written. It's already off to the publisher, and you'll be getting it. Stay tuned. But I talk about that issue and whether we're going to cross the line or not. But that's to come. All right. Let's go back to our callers here in Sacramento. This is John. Hello, John.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. Doing fine. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Hey. I had a quick question about debates and apologetics and the logical approach to them. I've heard a lot of them on, seen a lot on YouTube, listened to a lot of them, and I'm always kind of baffled by, as you were talking earlier about materialism and evolution and this atheistic worldview that I think, I'm going to misquote it, but I think... Richard Bakken says, you know, we're just dancing to the tune of our DNA, and
right.
we're just kind of molecules in motion and all
right.
this kind of stuff.
Right.
And I'm wondering if you've ever been in a situation where you're talking to somebody that has this worldview, and can you ever appeal to emotion a little bit and say, you know, if you reduce your worldview down to its logical conclusion, it means that the love you might have felt from your mother was just false. It was just some chemical reaction in your mother's head.
Yeah.
You know, or when I hear those things, you know, and I listen to these debates and these kind of the arrogant atheist attitude, mm-hmm. I think I feel sorry for their children. You know, because I think if I was this child in this audience listening to this, I would think, is that what my father thinks of me when he tucks me in at night? Or
right.
you know.
Well,
I'm just wondering if you've ever been in a situation to confront someone.
Well, the answer is yes. And but first, a corrective: that kind of confrontation is not an appeal to emotion. That
okay.
is that is an appeal to an awareness that awareness. Emotions are awarenesses, but not all awarenesses are emotions. It is an awareness of something that is true and real. That doesn't fit in one's worldview, and this is what you're identifying. On your worldview, love is just a chemical reaction, but we have an awareness that it's something different. And this is why when we say to our wives or to our children that we love you, we are not describing our chemical reactions. We are describing something else, something much more noble than chemical reactions. And I'll tell you when it happened to me. It happened to me when I was in a debate with John Baker, professor of philosophy at Calgary University of Calgary, in Calgary, Canada, Alberta, and the debate was about morality. Is morality objective, or is it relative? And I was arguing obviously that morality is objective, and for some reason, in arguing that it's relative, he made the statement that morality is relative like beauty is relative, that when you say something is beautiful, that you are just, and these were his words, you are just, I lost the exact word. You are, it's a projection. I can't remember the word. I'll think of it in a few minutes. But basically, we're projecting something that has no quality of beauty. We are smearing it. That's what he said. We're smearing this onto the thing, our concept of beauty. And by the same token, when we look at some behavior, we smear on our judgment, good or bad. So he's saying beauty is relative, morality is relative, and he's using that as an example. So when I offered my rebuttal to that point, here's what I said to the audience. I said, here we are on a plane right at the base of the Rocky Mountains. And it's a majestic view when you get up in the morning and you look to the west and you see these magnificent mountains. Now, you are having an experience of what you think is reality. And the experience that you're having is an experience of beauty. Now, you just have to ask yourselves tomorrow morning when you get up and you look at these mountains, are the mountains beautiful or are you smearing something on them? that it's just your personal view of them, and have you're not saying anything about the mountains themselves. And ultimately, one has to come to that point when one is beholding something with the gaze of their mind, as it were, and making these judgments, whether moral judgments or aesthetic judgments, that you just one has to just ask themselves, am I seeing beauty or am I just projecting nonsense? I'm projecting this stuff. Now, what I thought of the next day, this was Saturday night, and on Sunday morning I was in a church just being introduced to speak, and my mind was wandering a little bit. You'd be amazed at the things that go through one's mind before he's just about to stand up to speak. In this case, I was thinking about the debate the night before and what John Baker had said, and it suddenly occurred to me to ask, which I didn't, but it occurred to me to ask John Baker, have you ever told your wife she was beautiful? And
right. When
I thought of that question, I started laughing to myself. In fact, I had to control myself because I was about to stand up, and I'm chuckling. Oh, my gosh, that would have been great. I wouldn't have done it probably because it might have been too embarrassing, but it ought to have been embarrassing, because if what he said was true, then when he tells his wife she's beautiful, he's got to qualify it. And by the way, honey, I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about something I'm smearing on you that's totally inside of me right now.
Right.
Oh, you know, but that's what they're stuck with. And this was part of my point by my opening commentary this hour, is that this is what people like John Baker are stuck with doing. Saying nonsense, denying the obvious. And,
yeah, and
it happens all the time.
And it does seem like it's not ever addressed in debates. There's no, because as you say, there's no way to answer it. It's just never, it's always kind of shunned off to the side when it's brought up.
Well, maybe it's not in some debates. I don't know. But I in the book on tactics, the tactic taking the roof off is meant to address that particular kind of problem. In other words, John Baker, if your view is right, then when you tell your wife that she's beautiful, then you're not telling her the truth. All you could say to her is, honey, I'm smearing something that I think is beauty on you right now. That would be the truth.
Right.
Okay, so you're not telling the truth. This is where your worldview leads. Now, this notion of taking the roof off is a notion that I got from Francis Schaeffer and have used many, many times in the past. And basically what one is doing there is they are addressing the denial that the worldview that they hold puts them in, a denial of reality. And it's meant to show them the consequence of the worldview that they actually hold. And this is why it's called taking the roof off, because you're going to remove the roof of protection that is part of their denial that's protecting them from facing the consequences of their worldview. And you're letting the cold wind blow, so to speak. And
right.
So Francis Schaeffer was very good with that. It was a significant tactic, and it's one I use frequently to show people the error of to help them to get to see the error of their ways. Whether it's done in debates or not by others, I don't watch debates that much, but it might be done because it's legitimate, and I did it in my debate with John Baker. So you're on to something.
Okay. Well, hey, I appreciate it. I'll look at it that way instead of appealing to emotion. That's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, it's not an emotional appeal. It's an appeal to a rational intuition called coherence.
Yeah.
And it says your worldview entails something naturally. That's the coherence. It entails this. Now, if this thing that it entails is ridiculous, then there's something wrong with your worldview, which naturally entails it. So if your worldview, materialism, requires for you to deny free will or deny consciousness or deny morality, that these are all illusions, well, since consciousness and free will and morality are all real features of the world and of the self, then your worldview must be false.
Right.
It's incoherent. It actually, in that particular case, it's also contradictory, because in order to believe that materialism is true, having come to a conclusion, you have to use rationality, which requires free will, and free will is denied by your view. So it might be their view is true, but they could never know it, you know.
Right.
That kind of thing. So that's what's going on. It's not just an appeal to emotion, but it is striking very, very hard at the heart of their worldview, and that's a good move to make.
Hey, well, thank you very much.
Okay, John, good talking to you. Appreciate the call. Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and Chris, hello.
Hi, Greg. How are you doing?
Doing fine. Good to talk to you today, Chris. Thanks.
It's good to talk to you again, too. Listen, the owner of the company that I work for is a huge Joel Osteen fan.
Uh-huh.
And he approached me a few days ago about going to see Joel in concert in Greensboro as a motivational device for the company. But he approached me in this way. He says, if I asked you to do something without debunking it, would you please do it? So I don't know how familiar you are with Joel Osteen, but
there's plenty there to debunk. Let's just put it that way.
Exactly.
And
right. The owner's aware of how I have viewed Mr. Osteen's teachings. And that's what he said. So I thought about it. I asked him if I could think about it. He allowed me to. And I finally came back to him and said, you know what? If you invite the whole company and we all go, I'll go. And I will not voice my opinion unless asked.
Well,
and I said that for this reason, and I want to know what you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
There are several people with whom I work who are not Christians. They are unchurched. Now, I do work with a couple of Christians, but most of the folks aren't, and they're also unchurched. So they went as children, but, you know, this is the South, so that's what you do. It's just a cultural thing for them. And my thinking was that even though to someone who has done any study whatsoever, it should be clear that Osteen's teaching is askew and it's amiss, it might be enough to get someone started down the path.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it may be a wrong path, initially.
Well, then that's not a good start, is it? It's not path that we want them to start on. The fact is they're already on the wrong path. Wherever they're at, they're probably already on the wrong path, you know. And if they're just starting down the right path and Osteen gets a hold of them, then maybe he's going to steer them down the wrong path. Anyway, that's another issue, though. I don't think that would be a legitimate justification, what you just said, but there might be others. You're suggesting that if anybody's got a background is going to see that he's not right when it comes to spiritual things. I don't know if that's true, frankly, because he sure has taken in a lot of people that one thinks ought to know better and apparently does not. So let's just take this from the top. Your boss says, you know, if you go to this thing, will you not take exception with it? And I mean, I'd have a lot of questions to ask him. Maybe if I heard something that was egregiously false, are you asking me to stay silent? And do you think that's a good idea? So I'm putting this on the boss, and I'd want to say, would you like me to stay silent? What if he promoted? You know, is that what you're asking me? Do you think that's, you know, so I'd want to hold his feet to the fire a little bit for the request. But, you know, if he's, you know, I'm trying to get some public oration, I'm trying to get some positive mental attitude stuff going here with my people, and I'm just trying to do a good thing here, and I don't want you to, you know, mess everything up, and I'm putting out some money for this, and so blah, blah, blah. So you can kind of maybe see it from his view if he's not a Christian, all right? Can there be a legitimate reason for you to go to an event like that and not speak up? And I think, well, yeah, there could be. For one, you'd get a real clear picture of what Joel Osteen believes, or at least as he's promoting it at that event. And even though it may not be at the event that you speak up. There may be other occasions where you can speak regarding Joel Osteen in a way that's now educated because you've already heard him talk. So if there is a full-on gag order for this, and that's what your boss is requiring of you as part of your employment, you could still go, it seems to me, and benefit from it because you're getting a clarification on what this person believes, so that if there's some other person in view, then you can take exception with, like, when you're talking to another person unrelated to your work. However, if your boss is saying, you know, you can't shoot it out of the water when you're there, but what you say the next day is okay, then you still have some latitude. Now, it sounds to me what you said was, if I would not force my view on others unless asked. And did he approve of that qualification?
Sort of. He said that would be fine. He actually did say that he was not intending to use this as a religious exercise, although he is a Joel Osteen fan.
Yeah, but
he
cannot control that. He may not be intending it, but doesn't mean that it's not going to have a religious impact on his people. Joel Osteen is a religious speaker. How can he control the impact it's going to have on other people? He may not mean it to have that impact, but they could buy his theology, even if your boss doesn't even agree with it. But your boss must be, he could not be in strong disagreement if he's putting a gag order on you. He may disagree,
well,
but not strongly. Like, I disagree, but it doesn't matter.
Right. He and I have actually had the Joel Osteen conversation a couple of times when I made mention of what Scripture has to say about those mm-hmm. who tickle our ears.
Yeah.
People will, you know, tell, basically, I hear what I want to hear, and if somebody's telling me what I want to hear, I'm more likely to listen to them. But his intent was to use it as a motivational tool for the company to get guys together and to sort of get them fired up and excited, and that's his purpose.
Yeah, okay. Let me make this suggestion. I would not put it the way you put it. I wouldn't say I would not force my view, because giving your view is not forcing your view. It's just giving your view. He's asking you not to give your view. So you could say you're putting your own contribution in the most negative light if you put it that way, and I'm just suggesting there's a better way to put it. Maybe you would say, well, I will not give my view unless somebody asks. Okay, that's what I suggest that you say to him. And then when you all go to this thing, then you keep your word. And if somebody says, hey, what did you think? Then you say, are you asking my opinion? And they say, yes, now you're free to give it. As long as somebody else initiates, you clarify, are you asking my opinion? Then you've satisfied the requirement, you can give your view. You're not going to force anything on anybody. You can't do that, but you can give your view. Anyway, that's my advice, and there's our music, which means that hour went fast. Thanks so much for your call, Chris. I'm Greg Kokel. Hour number three just ahead on Stand to Reason. All right, folks. Greg Kokel here. Stand to Reason is the show. Trying to figure out what I want to talk about here as we kick off this this first hour. Well, two things that come to mind right off the bat. One is something that my something I thought of just the other day. Actually, this is one of those things where it keeps popping up in my mind as you're addressing challenges to your convictions. And sometimes addressing the challenge head on is appropriate. You give the best answer. But I've noticed that sometimes you give the best answer you're capable of. And a lot of these things, we could just knock these softballs out of the park. But I'm noticing another trend, though, in some of these challenges that it amounts to a commission of a certain fallacy in thinking that a lot of these questions fall into the category of. For example, last weekend we had Rethink, the Student Apologetics Conference, and it was a fabulous success. 1,053 students and conferees registered, largely the vast majority of them high school students, and it was fabulous. But after each speaker, there were questions that were given to the speaker. And one of the speakers, Tim Barnett from Toronto, was speaking on the issue of astronomy and the fine-tuned constants of the universe and the solar system and the radical improbabilities of these things happening by accident. To say that they're radical improbabilities it doesn't even do justice to the word improbability. And we're talking about finding one atom in the entire universe. That is, if all of the atoms in the universe ever were painted blue and one was red, you'd have to blindfolded pick the one atom by chance. That's the chance, for example, of some of these improbabilities. So it's radical. But a question that came up was, if God has created everything, why is there so much wasted space? And then Tim went on to explain that the space isn't wasted. It's actually, this amount of space is one of the fine-tuned constants. The universe needs to be as large as it is in order for life to be possible here on our planet. And if you're in astronomy, you understand how that works. I don't have the details. But when I heard the question, it suddenly occurred to me what the problem is in an informal fallacy kind of way with the question itself. It's what's called complex question. It's the fallacy of complex question. Now, you may not have heard this fallacy before, but I know that you've heard of the classic example of complex question, and that is the question, are you still beating your wife? Now, we chuckle because we realize that there's a shell game going on with the question, because to answer the question, are you still beating your wife, is to answer implicitly another question, and that is, I used to beat my wife. And it's an unfair question, because first you have to establish the first thing before the second thing is worth a legitimate question. You have to first establish that you used to beat your wife before you can ask the question, are you still doing that thing that you used to do? So this is the fallacy of the complex question. And this is the very fallacy that's in place when the person asks the question, why is there so much wasted space? Because what is the thing that is presumed by the question? That there is wasted space. So why is there so much wasted space presumes that there is wasted space. And when you ask the question that way, then it makes God look bad. But that presumes that there's wasted space. So my question would be to them, before I answer, why is there so much wasted space? I'd say, why are you presuming that it's wasted? And push it back on them. The right way to answer a complex question is to challenge the implied portion of the statement, the thing that's implied. If space is wasted, then why is there so much if God is so smart? Something like that. This also comes up in another in another challenge, very common to intelligent design. In fact, it's one that not only does Richard Dawkins make in his book, The God Delusion, but is one that was voiced to me when I debated Michael Shermer some 4 years ago on the question of the existence of God. And it was a radio debate, which still may be available in transcript form. I'm not sure. But they both raised the question, who designed the designer who created God? Okay? And Richard Dawkins says in his book, even a child knows to ask the question, who created God? Now, his point, his rhetorical point, is basically, this is such a significant problem for theists that even a child can see this difficulty, who created God? And if a child knows to ask this question, why would any adult not miss this kind of thing? Now, Michael Shermer, the same thing, who created God, you know, and he's offered this with a shrug, like this is such an impossible question for us to answer. But of course, it is impossible taken at face value, because in answering who designed the designer and who created God, if we answer it directly, or let me back up and put it this way, the question itself presumes the answer to another question that isn't explicit, it's implicit, or another issue, and that is that God was designed or that God was created. So when you say who created God, you're assuming God was created. Who designed God, you're assuming God was designed. And when did anybody claim such a thing on our side of the table? Never. Complex question. Are you still beating your wife? Exactly the same construction there. Now, I'll tell you the way that I responded when I was talking to, when I did my debate with Michael Shermer. I knew it was coming, and so I tried to put together a cogent or compelling or a pithy kind of response. When he said, who created God? I said, well, Michael, you don't believe that God was created because you don't believe in God. I don't believe that God was created because I think God was eternal. Nobody in our discussion believes God was created, so why are you asking the question, who created him? Now, that was a way of getting around, or like I said, a pithy way of trying to address this illicit challenge. And with regards to Richard Dawkins, yes, even children know to answer this question, but it isn't because of their profound knowledge. It's their lack of knowledge that they know to ask this question, rather. It's because they're kids. That's why they ask it. They don't conceive of an uncreated creator. And so it's natural for them to ask in their ignorance. But Richard Dawkins has got a PhD. He ought not be asking the kind of questions that children ask in their ignorance. In both cases, we have complex question. Why is there so much wasted space? Who designed the designer? Who created God? How about this same construal, but on a moral issue? Well, how can homosexuality be bad if God created me this way? So God creates me gay, and now he's going to condemn me for it? What's the presumption there? Are you still beating your wife? Right. It's the same kind of presumption. The presumption is that God created the person gay, and if he did, then why would he be condemning him? But see, that's the point that hasn't been established yet. Again, complex question. So I just want you to keep your eyes open for when some kind of form of the challenge, are you still beating your wife, shows up, but in conversation that deals with these kind of ultimate issues, whether they're moral or whether they have to do with the existence of God, because they do come up a lot. And you might be able to ferret it out by quickly asking yourself the question, are they presuming something in their question that they have not yet established? And if they're presuming something that hasn't been established, then this is an example of a complex question. And you want to go to the presumption first before you take any responsibility to try to deal with the issue directly yourself. All right. With that in mind, let's go to Robert in San Francisco and see what's on your mind. Robert, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, Greg.
Sure.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
All right. So my question is, what is going on in the early chapters of Genesis in terms of the Hebrew usage? Like, it seems that people are giving their children Hebrew names and, like, there's Hebrew mannerisms, like the use of parallelism, like inside the narratives, sometimes when people are speaking. Like, would these just be, in your view, like benign literary interpolations just because it was given to a Hebrew audience first?
Well,
in terms of how it works with history, you know?
I don't think they're benign. I think they are literary techniques. And I don't know in every case that you mentioned whether these are examples of literary technique. But there's no question that in throughout the Hebrew Bible, just like in the Greek Bible and the Greek portions, you have writers that are using literary forms that are meaningful to the listeners. And you and I are doing the same thing. When we speak persuasively, we are trying to garner forms that our listeners are familiar with. Did you hear that? Forms they're familiar with. There's alliteration, the F and the F. That creates a euphony or a nice sound to our ears, and it gives the statement a little bit more cogency or punch, forms that we're familiar with. So here I'm doing it as I'm talking with you. We are using literary devices that we are familiar with to make our points more forceful. And this, of course, happens all through the literature of the Bible, even the history of the Bible, like Genesis would be, because the writer is trying to speak in a compelling fashion or write in a compelling fashion to his audience. So you're going to have things that are in parallel. We see parallelisms in the Old and the New Testament as a literary device that the people understood, where things that are said in parallel, the second is meant to emphasize the first. I'm hearing some really weird noises in the background. Is that in your... Is that you?
I think it might be.
Okay, are you washing dishes?
On the sidewalk.
Okay, because all of that stuff comes across. So, okay, sometimes I'm not sure it's in our equipment, but that sounded like I heard a faucet running and then some stuff.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Okay, good. That's helpful if you. Okay, good. So, so we see this. We do see this in the Book of Genesis. We see thing.
For example, like Eve. The name Eve. It means, you know, in Hebrew, it's Chava. It means life giver, like probably whatever language they were speaking, you'd say maybe that name was given, life, whatever it was in their language.
Yeah, well, the names are more significant in the Hebrew mindset than they are in the, say, American English. Names were meant to signify things, and so when a child is born under a bitter set of circumstances, they might name the child Bitter or something like that. Now, we wouldn't think of that because we don't want the kid to be marked with that for life. But those kinds of things actually did happen in the Hebrew text. We have a phrase called in the generations of that we see first in Genesis chapter 2. I'm getting that sound again, that whatever that sound is in the background. And this, it means in the generations of, or something to that effect, and we see that phrase repeated a number of times, toledoth, in the Book of Genesis. We see things that are called chiasms, and chiasms are actually structures. They're structures in the account that where things move in a certain direction, like you have names of judges and that would move in a certain direction, and then they kind of move back in the other direction. There's an apex, so to speak. It's called a chiasm. It's kind of hard to demonstrate without drawing it on a paper. But the people of the time understood these notions, and so therefore they made use of these to communicate a little bit more effectively. Now, we miss a lot of this. We miss because we don't use the same kinds of structures in English that they used in Hebrew. So sometimes we miss the significance of either the naming or the structure that we see. Genesis 1, for example, has has a interesting structure. It has three different spaces that are identified in with three different days, and then those three different spaces are filled in successive days. So God makes the place. Place is formless and void. It has no shape, and it has nothing in it. So then God makes three kinds of shapes, the sky, the land, and the sea, and then he puts things in the sky, the land, and the sea. Then he fills it on successive days. So there's at least arguably, a literary form that is being taken advantage of in Genesis 1 that was meaningful to the authors, or rather to the readers. I think any time you are reading something that is culturally removed from you, you will understand the impact of the writing better if you understand the forms that are being used to communicate. Those forms that were maybe fairly familiar to an ancient Near Eastern culture, but would not be so familiar to us today. That's true not just in the book of Genesis, but also in the Gospels.
Okay. So would you say that, like, people between the time of Adam and Noah, or between, like, Adam and Noah's, between Adam and Abraham, are all those names? What does that do with those names then? Since they're kind of like Semitic names, but they're pre-Semitic people, does that cause an issue?
Well, I'm not sure what issue that would cause. Is someone suggesting, well, these are Semitic names before there were Semites, and therefore somebody Semitic must have written these into the text? They aren't really native to the original. Is that what's being suggested?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know why I would have to agree that Semitic names that are part of Semitic people now did not exist prior to the beginning of Abraham. Abraham is the first Jew because Jews are everyone that followed from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. All right, so he'd be the first Jew by definition, but that's also by like definition that all bachelors are unmarried males, you know what I'm saying? So that doesn't tell us much about the world. It just tells us about how we're defining words. There were Semitic peoples before Abraham. Abraham sure. Come from a group of people. Why would I believe that because the people before Abraham had names that sound Semitic that they somehow were dropped into the text? How does anybody know that a word like Shem, for example, like a name like Shem didn't exist before Abraham's time? How would anybody know that? And it must have been inserted into the text because Shem came after Abraham as a name. I mean, you're Robert. How do I know that there was nobody named Robert? In other words, those sounds weren't used. Bob. Was nobody called Bob before Abraham? Because that's like a Christian name, or that's an English name, or what? I don't. This doesn't take us anywhere reliable, is what I'm saying. This kind of analysis.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know about the all the linguistic issues here. I couldn't tell you that. But I am not going to be tempted to think that since the names that we see in the first chapters of Genesis are Semitic names, that these names must have been added sometime later because people before the Semitic races couldn't have had names that sounded this way. Maybe these names were very, very, very old and made their way into the Semitic languages. I mean, isn't that possible?
It is a possibility, yes.
Yeah. But I'm speaking out of my can. I'm not a linguist, but all I can say is right now I'm not tempted by that notion. I'm not tempted to suspect that based
all
on
right.
those things.
Right, so thank you for your answers. It's really helpful.
Okay, I appreciate the call, Robert. Wasn't entirely sure where that was going or whatever, but there you go. Let's take a break and then come back with more calls on Stand to Reason.
The Apostle Paul knew well the effect on those who engaged in empty chatter as they spread the virus of false knowledge. They went astray. So while entrusting the treasure of truth to Timothy, his disciple, and encouraging Timothy to entrust it to other faithful men, Paul also exhorted him to guard the treasure in 2 Timothy 1:14. Paul's word guard comes from the activity or office of a watchman who has the job of protecting those who are asleep from harm. It implies a deliberate, conscious act and demands discernment in knowing what it is that's been placed under our care. Guard the treasure was Paul's final message to Timothy before Paul's death. It reflected the heartbeat of his ministry. It reflects the heartbeat of Stand to Reason, too. Guard the treasure which has been entrusted to you. To learn more about Stand to Reason and how we're training Christian ambassadors to guard the treasure, visit us at str.org. Our website is full of unique and useful resources to train you to be an effective ambassador for Christ. That's str.org.
Would you like brief, easily digestible answers to some of the challenges you face as a Christian ambassador? Well, that's why we created our Ambassador's Guide series of booklets. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. With these booklets, you'll receive concise and approachable guides to various philosophies like pluralism and postmodernism, world religions such as Islam and Mormonism, even strategies on how to answer the challenges of the new atheists. To order a booklet from the Ambassador's Guide series, visit our online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON.
Just thinking here about that last call, what occurred to me, and it's something to think about, let's just say that Semitic languages had their genesis around the time of Abraham. Let's just say you have linguists that can kind of trace these things back, and I think amazing things can be done with etymology, which is the study of the history of words. Why couldn't it be possible that maybe Eve, whose name means living or mother of the living, maybe her name was spoken differently by non-Semitic peoples that preceded her, but the name itself was then retranslated for the sake of the Semitic peoples, so they don't miss it. So let's say she was named Bios, you know, like biology. Bios is a root that means life. Maybe she was Bios, but then when you're talking to Semitic people, you don't say the Bios part. You say, well, in our language, that would be Eve. Why isn't that possible? You know, if you have a friend named Roberto in Spanish, would it be legitimate to say, this is Robert? Because Robert is the English way of characterizing Roberto, or Guillermo, which is William in English, or Liam is Gaelic or whatever for William, I guess. So couldn't we do a translation possibly if we have a new audience? So if there's a name that has a meaning in another language, and then I'm trying to communicate it in this language, wouldn't it be legitimate for me to use the words that are the translated concepts in our language so people understand, oh, this is life. This person's actual name is life, is what their name is. So in English, it would be life. Wouldn't they do that in Semitic languages? I don't know. I'm just taking a shot at it. When we had the break, it occurred to me that that might be another way of looking at it. In any event, let's go to Adria in Fort Worth, Texas. Adria?
Yes.
Welcome to Stand to Reason.
Thank you.
What's on your mind today?
Well, I have a friend of mine. He's been a friend for a long time, and he is homosexual.
Uh-huh.
And he lately has posted a couple of long posts on Facebook asking for answers. He's been suffering for many months now with panic attacks, severe anxiety, deep depression. He's not able to go to work, and he's crying out for answers.
Right.
And I would love to approach him with Christianity, but with the delicacy of the topic, I don't know how to approach it, to use your words, in a winsome manner.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. First with prayer, which I'm sure you're already employing in this circumstance. The reason that I pause is here's I have some thoughts, but I just want to qualify them.
Okay.
I think what our temptation to think is that, gee, you know, he's feeling panic, he's feeling anxiety, depression. If we can get him to come to the Lord, then maybe he would see the truth, experience forgiveness, and not experience panic, anxiety, and depression. I don't know if that's the case, though, because there are people who understand the Lord, who are Christians, who love the Lord, who understand grace, who still experience panic, anxiety, and depression. The church is filled with people like that, and that is not necessarily an evidence of spiritual weakness. Sometimes people are involved in things they shouldn't be involved with, okay? And because of that, they have emotional problems. So a person who, well, Paul, David himself said, Psalm 51, or maybe it's Psalm 32, when I kept quiet about my sin, my body wasted away. And then finally, I confessed my sin, and, you know, that changed everything. I'm looking for it right now. I think it's, yeah, maybe in Psalm 32 is the blessedness of forgiveness and of trust in, yeah, here it is. When I kept silent about my sin, my body wasted away through my groaning all day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was drained away as with the fever heat of summer. I acknowledged my sin to you, and my iniquity I did not hide. I said, I will confess my transgression to the Lord, and you forgave the guilt of my sin. Therefore, let everyone who is godly pray to you in a time when you may be found. Surely in a flood of great waters they will not reach you. Now, I think what he's saying there is if we don't hide our sin, but we acknowledge it, then we're going to get release from God's discipline. And we don't have to go through certain discipline that is based on us denying our sin. And then he says, you are my hiding place. You preserve me from trouble. You surround me with songs of deliverance. Okay. So now here is the point. So I don't want to be misunderstood. So here is the point that I'm making from Psalm 32. There are times when our panic, our anxiety, our depression are evidence of unrepentant sin. We are living in rebellion against God, and that rebellion is having a terrible psychological impact on our lives. And if we do what David did and says, I acknowledge my sin to you, my iniquity I did not hide, I said I will confess my transgressions to the Lord. We do those things. We don't hide. We acknowledge. There are times, then some of the time, we get a tremendous sense of relief from the panic, anxiety, and depression.
Sure, okay. Makes sense.
Well, I've experienced it myself, and I'm sure
yeah,
that...
Me too.
Yeah, there you go. Now, is homosexuality a sin? Yes.
Yes.
Is it possible that the panic, anxiety, and depression of your friend is associated with his sinful behavior? The answer to that, to me, is yes, it is clearly possible. It may not be the reason he's feeling that, but it certainly is possible. Now, the concern I have is if we hold out Christ and forgiveness to someone as the antidote to their panic, anxiety, and depression, and then they make a move to trust Christ and the panic, anxiety, and depression doesn't go away, then they might be thinking, well, see, Jesus doesn't work.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
Because what we've held Jesus out for is something that he was not necessarily intended to do. Jesus is there to forgive our sins and to make us right before God. And that's what that's what David says. I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the guilt of my sin. So if we go to Christ based on our sin, and our need for him in virtue of our sin, then Christ will do for us what we're looking for him to do, forgive us.
Okay.
People say, does Jesus work? And I say, well, it depends what you want him to do. If you want him to forgive your sin, yes. If you want him to get rid of your panic, anxiety, and depression, not necessarily. That may happen. It may not. Because maybe those three things are a result of something else in your life. Now, I think homosexuality is developmental. A lot of good evidence, clinical evidence, points to that. That means that early on in life, there are circumstances that cause gender confusion. Very early in life, before that many children are consciously aware, there are circumstances that cause gender confusion. If gender confusion is developmental, even after a person does not pursue the homosexuality that their gender confusion is an evidence of, then they are not living in that sin. They still may have panic, anxiety, and depression over the original things they were confused about.
Okay.
So forgiveness solves one problem, the biggest problem, the most important problem. It doesn't solve every problem. And there are Christians that live with depression. There are famous Christians that live for a long time with depression. My understanding is the Spurgeon struggled with depression. Did he understand the gospel? Yes. Was he forgiven? Absolutely. Did he get it? Yes. But he still had to deal with his own emotional difficulties. So all of that is a foundation for this piece of advice. I think you should talk to your friend. And I think that you should tell him about what Jesus offers. And but I would say to him, I'd try to make a clear look at here's first things first. God oftentimes will use emotional pain in our life to drive him, rather, to drive us to himself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good thing because we desperately need him for forgiveness. However, I cannot guarantee if you turn to the author of life for forgiveness, and he's the only one that can give you that forgiveness, that that means he's going to take away all your problems. It doesn't work that way, and so I can't promise it. I will tell you this. You need Jesus. You need God's hand in your life. You need that whether you're feeling panic, anxiety, and depression or not. If you were deliriously happy, you would still need Jesus because you'd still be guilty before God. And one day there's going to be a price to pay for that. So let's get first things first. Let's get right with God. And then we can think about the other things. It might be that fessing up regarding a lifestyle that's dishonoring to God is the thing that's going to have a huge impact on these emotional problems he's experiencing, because maybe those are there because he's swimming upstream. He's as Jesus put it in the book of Acts, recorded there, kicking against the goads. And his kicking against the goads is causing all this panic, anxiety, and depression. I don't know. It may be, but it may not be. It may be a whole host of other things, and he needs God's help for it all.
Yes, yes, it's been my assumption that because I know he has mentioned briefly, very very briefly, about going to church. So I know he knows, but so it's been my assumption that possibly because he knows, yet he's still living this lifestyle, that's what's causing his problem. But
sure.
I like the point of view you handed me that. Because I, on my own, I probably would have approached it from the wrong angle.
Uh-huh. Yeah. There's no question that the homosexuality is a moral problem. But if he wasn't a homosexual, he still could be experiencing these things. And even with that out that moral problem, he would have other moral problems like everybody else that would need to be addressed before the Lord. And when people ask me about, witnessing to homosexuals, my advice is that if they have not made homosexuality an issue, don't you make the issue, because even without the homosexuality, they still need Christ just as much.
Yeah.
And so, but since, you know, this is, this may be relevant, I'm not sure. And is this somebody that you actually know personally, or just somebody that has found their way onto your Facebook?
I know him very personally.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah, I would, yeah, since he's mentioned about church, of course, church isn't the answer. Christ is the answer. You understand the distinction there. But it shows that he may be reaching out regarding Christ in a way that the only way he knows how. Well, I guess that means church. And so this is where, and going to church, I think would be great if he went to a church that was communicating the gospel and would welcome him with open arms, even though he's sins at this point in his life in this particular way. Some churches won't like that, you know.
Right.
And in my view, Jesus catches his fish first and then he cleans them, you know. So the cleaning.
I've heard you say that before.
Yeah, pardon me?
I've heard you say that before. Yeah. I like that.
So I think that this is this may just communicating to him that he needs Christ regardless, and also suggesting that the life he's living is not honoring to God, and this might be the source of his struggle, is that he's not willing to agree with God on this one. That might be worth talking with him about too. But let's get Jesus front and center in this circumstance. And then take it from there. And God can do amazing things. He has done incredible things in transforming people's lives with habits and sins and difficulties and things. But at the same time, he also doesn't always deliver in that way. Sometimes he delivers from, and other times he delivers through. Let me just say it again. Sometimes he delivers from affliction. Sometimes he delivers through the affliction. So,
okay.
All righty?
All right. I appreciate your advice, and I appreciate your show. It has been a wonderful resource for me. Thank you.
Well, I'm so glad to hear that, Adria. Thanks for the call.
Thank you for listening.
All right. You're welcome. Let's go to break, and we'll be back for our final segment on Stand to Reason.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to iDonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit iDonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org. Or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
Final segment here on Stand to Reason. And I have something else I want to share with you that's going on the college level that has to do with homosexuality. And I'm just apprising you of this activity. The liability, of course, is that some of you are saying, not a homosexuality again. Well, I'm not pursuing the issue proper. I'm trying to show you the role it's playing in the public discourse, particularly as it affects the proclamation of the Christian worldview, foundationally, the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so I'm not saying bringing up any of these things to complain or whine, but to rather continue to point out that the culture is heating up against Christianity. And the issue of homosexuality is the point of the spear. It is the weapon that is being used by the world, biblical concept there, by the world, to make things hard on followers of Christ. I probably shouldn't use the word Christian anymore because too many Christians are just giving in on this one. And this is, I think, a demonstration that they are not followers of Christ. This is a line in the sand. It is the line in the sand being drawn right now to test whether we're going to be faithful. The latest thing, and it seems like every week there is something new that has come up that is exemplifies this point. The point being, and Jesus said it best in Matthew chapter 10, simply put, they treated me this way, they're going to treat you this way. The master is above his student, the student is above the master. So if they treated me badly, they're going to treat you badly too. Be ready for it, okay? Here, I'm just scanning Matthew 10. I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. So be shrewd as serpents and innocent as doves. Beware of men. They will hand you over for my sake. Brother will betray brother to death. You will be hated by all because of my name. But it is the one who is endured to the end who will be saved. That's verse 22. So it's all in there. I think Matthew 10 is the chapter for now and maybe for the near future for followers of Christ. Verse 26, therefore do not fear them, for there is nothing concealed that will not be revealed or hidden that will not be known. Do not fear those who kill the body, but who cannot kill the soul. Rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. That's fear God, not them. Do not fear, you are more valuable than many sparrows. 26 to 31, in the space of six verses inclusively there, do not fear three times. You think that has anything to do with the things we're facing now and the challenges that we're feeling? And here, this article, headline says, Accreditation Board gives Gordon College a year to review policy on homosexuality. Gordon College, that's that back east somewhere, right? The regional body that accredits colleges and universities has given Gordon College a year to report back about a campus policy on homosexuality, one that may be in violation of accreditation standards. Did it ever occur to you, why is it that an accreditation body, that is the body that formally says, we can acknowledge that you give a good education here. Why should they have anything to say about one's moral proclamations about sexual behavior? Or the moral behavior that it requires of its students, in the case of a Christian college? Isn't that basically saying, we are going to withhold accreditation from you because you are asking your students to restrain themselves sexually? therefore you can't be considered a credible institution with regards to education? The article continues, the Higher Education Commission of the New England Association of Schools and Colleges, that's with the NEASC, met last week and considered whether Gordon College's traditional inclusion of homosexual practice as a forbidden activity. So they're including in forbidden activities homosexualities. You are Christians, you can't do these activities, homosexuality among them. If that runs afoul of the commission's standards for accreditation. Now, I'm wondering, why would this even, well, of course I know this is a way of the culture going after Christians, but I mean, but why would the commission care about that kind of thing? And let's see if I read further in the article, and here's what it says. NEASC placed Gordon College on its September agenda after news broke in July that Lindsay, that would be Lindsay, I guess, is the Michael Lindsay, president of Gordon College, that Lindsay had signed a letter with other religious leaders supporting an exemption from an executive order prohibiting federal contractors from discriminating based on sexual orientation. Now, that's a sentence that sounds like it's got like five negatives in it, so I'm going to tell you what it means. There was an executive order. That's like the president, right? The president says that federal contractors cannot discriminate based on sexual orientation. Okay. I guess then this is then construed by NEASC that they're federal contractors, so they cannot discriminate sexually and on sexual behavior, and nor apparently by connection can schools they approve discriminate regarding sexual behavior. So this Christian school signed a letter that asked that they be considered exempt from this the impact of this executive order. So really what's happening, if you follow the links, is the president of the United States makes a declaration on his authority. That's what an executive order is. That on his authority alone will have, it looks like, the result of disqualifying Christian colleges from their policy on sexual behavior allowed within their groups. How does that happen? How is it that one man gets to declare that Christian colleges cannot receive accreditation because they have this moral standard that he is not comfortable with? Do you see the impact that this is going to have, not just on Gordon College, but any Christian college that wants to stay Christian in its moral expectations of its allegedly Christian students? Anyway, the fact that Michael Lindsay signed his name to a letter asking for an exemption from this executive order, this drew attention to him. Wait a minute, this guy signed this letter asking for an exemption, which means he's probably not doing what this executive order says he ought to be doing. We better find out about this guy and his school. That's what happened. He signed the letter that led to scrutiny about the now infamous Gordon College policy, which it calls the life and conduct statement. Can't universities have, especially Christian schools, have conduct statements? Don't universities now require at some level honesty? You can't cheat, you get thrown out of school. That's a conduct. That prohibits a range of activities such as sex outside of marriage, which would include homosexuality, at least most of it, except for in those cases where, I guess, there is a de jure marriage, that is, legally they're married. I don't think any homosexual marriage is a marriage. It's a contradiction of terms. That's another issue. and also prohibits drinking and smoking on campus or at college functions and homosexual practices. What do they think about smoking? Are they going to say, how dare you prohibit smoking? You can't get accreditation because you're prohibiting smoking. No, they're not going to touch that because that's a leftist cause that they're in favor of. No smoking. But homosexual practice, on the other hand, no, you can't do that. Picking and choosing, okay? So now the college's board of trustees has the authority to change the policy, said a spokesman for Gordon College. The working group, and what Michael Lindsay has done is he has formed a working group on their Wenham campus to review the college's policy related to homosexual practice. So they're, now they got to look at it. And look, anybody's got to form a group, no matter what Michael Lindsay actually believes about the legitimacy of this challenge, which to me is so far in left field, I cannot even believe it. I mean, on the merits, I expect this kind of stuff. That's why I read Matthew 10. But on the merits, this is ludicrous, all because a presidential executive order. Nope, we don't like this, so we're just making a decision unilaterally, one man. That's going to affect all of these campuses eventually. How can, if Gordon College doesn't escape this, how could any college escape it? How could any school, how could any Christian school require Christian moral behavior of its students? They can't. Not if this goes through. So now there's a policy that is policy group or a working group, they call it here, that will take a look, and it will issue its first preliminary report in November. It will present the trustees with a full summary of the discussions that take place in time for the next trustees meeting, etc. So anyway, so this is a work in progress. We're going to figure out, they're going to figure out how to respond. But then it goes on. It says the members of the working group, this is this ad hoc committee that's going to discuss how we got to respond to this challenge that will put this company, this school out of business if they don't adhere to it. You see that, don't you? This is the death blow. Because if a Christian school loses its accreditation on this kind of thing, who's going to send their kids to that school? Well, some might. But that means their kids aren't going to get any accreditation. Now, this is the death knell for that school. And this is what's going on. We're going to put you out of business unless you're in lockstep with us about homosexuality. Do you see it there? By the way, who's putting you out of business? The president. The president. It's an executive order. One man. Just stating the facts here. All right. The members of the working group include trustees, faculty, administrators, staff, and students, Sweeney said. At least one of the students is gay. Frankly, I don't. This is a fruit of the '60s. Oh, the students get to say how the university is run. I personally don't agree with that. Anyway. Goes on to write that some of it goes on to say in this article that some of the faculty members on the working group have been vocally opposed to Gordon College's life and conduct policy. Now, this floored me. Asked if the working group will consider eliminating the policy entirely, Sweeney said he believes this will be among the options that the working group considers. Okay, so we're a Christian organization, and we have Christian College. We have a life and conduct statement which says there are certain things you can't do. Now, I'm not in favor of blue laws. We don't smoke, drink, or chew or go with those that do. That is, I don't favor making issues of the exercise of Christian conscience, issues of judgment, that is. We don't take a thing that's not wrong in itself and then make it wrong. Okay, you can't dance. If you're in our school, you can't dance. And if you dance, we're going to kick you out. Or if you smoke or what. Look, these things are not sins. And they shouldn't be a requirement, okay? But when it comes to sin, that's a different story. I hope you guys see the difference. I'm not in favor of these legalistic codes that are man-made rules. But the rule regarding homosexuality is not man-made. Anyone can come to the church, come whoever will may come into Christianity, but there are rules for belonging. Does everybody understand this? The New Testament is filled with them. There's a certain conduct. We are to follow Christ. How are we who died to sin, how do we still live in it? Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and you don't do the things that I say? Okay, so being a Christian entails we got some rules. All right. How is it that there are faculty members and this Christian university who have been vocally opposed to the life and conduct policy? We are faculty members at Gordon College Christian University, and we are opposed to telling our young people that they shouldn't be in egregious sexual sin, living in that. Well, maybe they just mean their own opposed to the smoking parts or the dancing parts or the drinking parts. I don't know. But that isn't the way it reads to me. At least one of the students is gay, and some of the faculty members in the working group have been vocally opposed to the Gordon College's life and conduct policy. How does that happen? Well, maybe Michael Lindsay hired these guys. And now they're hanging around his neck. Or maybe, I don't know anything about this man or his views. Maybe he's not interested in keeping the old ways either. I'm not trying to cast aspersions on him. I don't know. But these are people on his faculty that are fighting him on a moral issue. And they're not being a friend to him and to the university and to Christianity in this regard. I just don't get it. I don't understand when the text is so clear on certain things, how people that identify themselves as Christians can flaunt it. I don't get it. Anyway, well, there you go. Thank you so much for spending time with me, ladies and gentlemen, friends, brothers and sisters, as the case may be. And give them heaven, all right? Give them heaven this week. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Bye-bye now.
Listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.